Okay, we like to start basically on time. It's a nice thing to do for every for all of you who did show up on time to start on time. So we will get going right now. Share my screen and. Okay. We've been dealing with the same verses for quite a few weeks now, and we will continue to deal with it at least today and maybe also next week. Also, he who fatally strikes a man shall be put to death. If he did not do it by design, but it came about by an act of God, I will assign you a place to which he can flee. When a man schemes against another and kills him treacherously, you shall take him from my very altar to be put to death. And I highlighted the word here, let whore go. I just want to talk a little bit about the verb that is used here in this text for killing. Notice that in the first verse, it's makeh ish vamit. It's more descriptive. Struck another person, and that other person died. But here, it's le or go, and the verb, as we pointed out, is la is harag, which is translated here as kill, which is good translation. And the question that I'd like to begin today's class with is the question of whether there is a difference in Hebrew between murdering and killing. And some of you may know this already, but I think it's worth studying again that Rashbam, Rabbi Samuel ben Meir, who most of you know is my favorite Bible commentator, makes a big deal about the difference between murdering and killing. Here is his comment. He comments on the difference between these verbs in his commentary on the Ten Commandments. Lo tirzach. And he writes, I'll read the Hebrew for a second and then look at the English translation. Just want you to hear in the Hebrew, those of you who understand the Hebrew, the repetitive nature of what Rashbam is saying. Repetitive because he's trying to make the point unambiguously, really strongly. Kol ritzicha hariga bechinam hi bechol makom. Every time the verb ratzach appears, ratzach always, whenever it appears, refers to unjustified homicide. So I'm sure you all know that when translating the Ten Commandments, the question is how to translate the sixth commandment, which many people translate as thou shalt not kill, you shall not kill. And others translate it as you shall not murder. And Rashbam is coming down very clearly on the side that the text actually means murder. And then he explains the difference between the verb lirtzoach and the verb laharok. And so he says that the resh tzadi chet, the verb resh tzadi chet is always used for unjustified homicide, hariga bechinam, killing for no particular, for no good reason. For example, the murderer must be put to death. Mot yumat harotzeach. The rotzeach there obviously means somebody who committed an unjustified killing. So what's a justified killing? Just to be clear, so justified killing could be if I'm, let's say, I'm defending my own life. Somebody's coming to kill me. In English, if somebody was coming to kill me and I killed them first, I wouldn't say, if I'm speaking English, I wouldn't say I murdered him. Because murder, it implies culpability. Or if I'm a soldier in the army and there's a battle going on and I killed one of the people from the enemy who was trying to kill me, I wouldn't say I murdered him. But we just don't do that in English. We don't use the verb murder in that way. And Rashbam here is making the point that the Hebrew verb lirtzoch is like the English verb to murder. And it is used only for unjustified homicide. So the first example, Mot Yumat HaRotzeach, a passage talking about how to deal with somebody who committed premeditated homicide. HaRatzachta V'gam Irashta, the prophet says this to the king who killed, to King Ahav. Eliyahu says this to King Ahav, who killed his neighbor Nabot and took over his vineyard. Would you murder and also take possession? How could you do something like this? This was unjustified killing. And Yeshayahu writes, Tzedek Yalin Bav Atam Mirasrim. Righteousness used to dwell in Jerusalem, and nowadays is murderers there. And so there again, the verb resh tzarichet is being used for unjustified homicide. But the verbs harag and mut, lahamit, sometimes refer to unjustified homicide. For example, and he came, killed him, by yahargehu. So the same thing in English, we could say, when we're talking about somebody who committed premeditated homicide, we could say he committed murder, or we could say he killed that person. And so the verb kill in English isn't taking a stand. It could be referring to somebody who committed unjustified killing, and it could be referring to somebody who defended his own life, or who killed some enemy of the people in a battle, is getting a hero's is being rewarded as a hero for having done this killing. Rashbam points out that just like the verb kill in English, so the verb laharog in Hebrew can be referring either to an unjustified killing, like when Cain kills Abel, it says by Yahargehu, the Yesh Betin, and it also can be used when referring to a justified killing, Kamo Beharagta et Aisha, you shall kill the woman. This is referring to a court of law, and the example that Rashbam gives here, I kept wondering, over the years, I always wondered why Rashbam took this pleasant example. The text there is talking about a woman who is guilty of bestiality. And it says, you shall kill the woman. What it means is to execute the woman. In other words, this is something that the law is, suggesting. So today, I decided that I'd look into the question. I found that actually the verb laharog, being used for the action of a beit din actually appears only three times in the Bible, only in three verses in the Bible. One about a male indulging in bestiality. The second one about a woman indulging in bestiality. And the third one is in the book of Devarim, in a description of a nesit, of someone who is enticing people to go and worship idols. So those are the three examples, none of them all that pleasant, that Rashbam had to choose from for using harag referring to what a Beit Din does. But his point seems to be very clear, and we English speakers totally understand this point, because we do make a strong difference in our language between murder and kill. And as Rashbam says about Hebrew, we do the same thing in English. We use the verb kill both to describe a killing that we think is justified. For example, even if you're against even if you're against capital punishment, you still know that when somebody's trying to kill you, when the soldiers of the enemy are coming and trying to kill you, it is considered justified to defend your life and end up killing the enemy. And can also use kill to describe an unjustified killing. But murder we would only use for unjustified killing. And so Rashbam is making the point here that if he spoke English, he would be saying to us, you have to translate the sixth commandment here as you shall not commit murder, and not as you shall not kill. We'll talk, after we read his entire comment here, we're talking about why he is making this comment, and why is he making this comment so forcefully. In the beginning, he says, Kol Ritzicha b'chol makom. It's always that way. But then Rashbam knows that actually there's a little problem with this nice tight distinction that he made here. He said, when the verse says, one who unwittingly slew a fellow man. This is the JPS translation, which I use whenever I can. Notice what the JPS did here. The verse there is talking about somebody who accidentally kills somebody else, and it uses the verb ratzach. And ratzach, we usually translate, Rashbam is saying ratzach should be, it should be translated as murder, but JPS just doesn't want to say that here. Unwittingly murder a fellow man, because we don't say that in English. So JPS is making the English be a little more fitting for the way in which we speak English today, who unwittingly slew a fellow man, Asher Yirtzach et Re'eu Bivlidat. Now Rashbam comes up with a pretty logical argument why they would use the verb ratzach in that verse, even though it is not talking about culpable premeditated homicide. Rashbam writes, since the greater context there deals with premeditated murder, the text says that if such murdering, ritzicha, takes place unwittingly, then there is no penalty. So it's a reasonable argument to say that since the text is talking in general about murder, which means premeditated culpable homicide, and then it says if it was done unwittingly and not in a culpable kind of way, and so it's using that same verb. It's a nice explanation. It actually doesn't work, though, because Deuteronomy chapter 4 is talking only about accidental homicide. It is not talking about premeditated homicide. There's no reference to premeditated homicide in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Is it possible that Rashbam, the general feeling is that there were few copies of the Bible around that people were using. That's not like, I'm sitting here with three different copies of the Tanakh on my desk. Back in the 12th century, people didn't have such immediate access to the text, and they very often quoted the text from their own memory. is it possible that Rashbam is confusing that verse in Deuteronomy chapter 4 with the verse in Deuteronomy chapter 19, which is almost the same language? Zed devar harotzeach asher yakeh et re'ehu bivlida'at. That phrase, bivlida'at, appears both in chapter 4 and in chapter 19. Maybe he was referring to that. And in chapter 19, the context discusses both premeditated culpable homicide and also accidental non-culpable homicide. Maybe that's what he's referring to. And so he's making the point that there is a sharp distinction between ratzach and harag in Hebrew, in the same way that we have that distinction in English, and in the same way Rashbam could be thinking about this, but because of course he was, aside from his knowledge of Hebrew and Aramaic, he spoke French on a regular basis. And in French also, we have a sharp distinction between the verb meurtre and the verb tuer, to murder and to kill. And he's saying that there is that same distinction in the Hebrew. And now, in the next slide, we'll see why Rashbam is making this point quite as strongly as he is making it. He says here, I offered this explanation as an argument against the heretics, the minim, that in Rashbam's Hebrew and in the Hebrew of many medieval Jewish authors and classical Jewish authors, minim means Christians. I offered this explanation as an argument against the Christians, and they admitted that I was right. Rashbam, a number of times in his Torah commentary, mentions discussing the Torah with Christians. And there's this shift that took place between the days of Rashi. Rashi, we recall, was Rashbam's grandfather. Rashi, in his Torah commentary, never reports on any conversations that he had with Christians. It's likely that he did have conversations with them, but it is possible that in the days of Rashbam, there were more conversations between Jews and Christians about the meaning of the Bible. And Rashbam, as I said, a number of times in his Torah commentary, reports on these conversations. And when he reports, he always says that I convinced them that I was right. You know, we don't have the version of the Christians who were talking with him. They admitted that I was right. And he says, even though in their Latin books, the same verb is used to translate the verb mem vav taf in the phrase when God speaking in Ha'azinu in Deuteronomy 32, God says, Ani amit ba'achaye, I deal death and I give life. And of course, we would never translate. We wouldn't say that God said, I murder and I give life. That would be unthinkable to use a verb like that there. And the verb ratzach in this verse, in lo tirzach, thou shalt not ratzach, they use the same verb. And you can see on the left-hand slide, those of you who are as old or older than me and in Canada and were forced to learn Latin back in high school, or some of you might have actually studied Latin even though you weren't forced to study Latin, you can see that in the translation of the Ten Commandments, lo tirzach comes out in Latin as non occides. And when God says, ani amit va'achaye, he says, ego okedam et ego wewera fakiam. And so that's that same verb there, okides and okidam. It's fascinating that Rashbam is alluding to what it says in the Vulgate, in the Latin translation that all the Christians around Rashbam were using. Scholars argue about the question of whether this proves that Rashbam read Latin. I consider it unlikely that Rashbam read Latin, because there was actually only one way to learn how to read Latin back in the 12th century, and that was in a monastery. There weren't, you couldn't take an intro Latin course at York University in order to, there was no neutral place for studying Latin. And I guess it's possible that he hung around with the Christians so much that they taught him how to read Latin. I personally find that unlikely. I personally find it likely that he was talking about the issue with the Christians, and they said, "Well, this is what it says in our in the Bible that we're reading." And he said to them, "Well, then the Bible that you're reading isn't accurate." He finishes off, "Heim lo dictico." The Vulgate. The Vulgate makes mistakes. A scholar in Spain named Montse Lera, who did her PhD in here at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, about a 12th century French scholar named Andrew of Saint Victor from the monastery of Saint Victor, which is just on the outskirts of Paris. And we know that Rashbam lived in the north of France, and we know that he spent some time in Paris. We have no reason to think that he lived there all of his life, but we know that he was in Paris at various points, at a point or various points in his life. Montse Lera has argued in her book on the subject that the strongest influence on the Bible commentaries of Andrew of St. Victor was Rashbam. And she considers it very unlikely that Andrew of St. Victor read Rashbam. She just thinks that it's likely that they talked about the text. And who knows, this could be a report on a conversation. They're saying, well, Andrew is always writing things like, in the Vulgate, it says thus and such, but the Jews tell me that. And the question is, who are these Jews who tell Andrew Montse Lera, who spent 10 years living here in Israel studying modern classical and medieval Hebrew and the flow of Jewish commentary literature, has said that Andrew of St. Victor's commentary was most strongly influenced by Rashbam. I wrote something on the subject. You can see at the bottom of this slide on the left-hand side here. Does the Torah differentiate between murder and killing? If you want to read about this in greater detail than what you will hear today, you can look up what I wrote at the website of the Torah, the Torah.com. If you don't write down that whole link, if you just write in a Google window, "Lakshan kill murder," you'll get this article right away. Okay, it seems that Rashbam is making a strong argument here. Why is Rashbam making this argument? I think that there are two possibilities, but I think that in the bottom line there is really only one possibility on the issue. I am skeptical about the idea that there's something ideological going on here, and that Rashbam is trying to support Jewish ethics as opposed to Christian ethics. I think he's just talking about a linguistic issue. And we'll talk about that other possibility of a distinction between Jewish ethics and Christian ethics. I just don't think that that was a major theme in the 12th century, a discussion of this nature. I see no other evidence about this, but I'll say some more about it. But first of all, I will point out, you know, I used to love this comment of Rashbam, and I used to be convinced that he was right until I read Professor Gerald Blitzstein's Zichrono Livracha's article about capital punishment a number of years ago, an article that I have mentioned a few times here, and then I realized that there is a very big problem with Rashbam's theory. So Glinstein says, many Jews believe that Judaism is a realistic, hard-headed system committed to a law of justice rather than a chaos of love. That those Christians, they say, don't kill, you know, that they're against, they claim to be against all killing, and they believe that they think that love is the most important thing. An obvious line Jews often argue is being drawn between a faith that reads, you shall not murder. That's how a Jew should read the sixth commandment, to read it as you shall not murder. And then the text is admitting that there are times when you could have to kill, because, you know, if you want to defend the country that you live in, and you want to have an army is going to have to kill sometimes, because there are bad people out there and they have to be killed. And one that naively and unrealistically demands, you shall not kill. Glinstein is not saying that Rashbam had this worldview, that's the difference between Judaism and Christianity, the difference between you shall not murder and you shall not kill. And as I said, I find it difficult to believe that was what was motivating Rashbam. But Rashbam was interested in language, and it's just like the question of what's a good way of understanding this text. And in talking with the Christians, he realized that they're using that same verb, okidei is okidam, for these two passages, one for ratzach and one for harag. For those of you who don't know Latin, you do know this verb. You know it from suicide, fratricide, all these verbs in English where we use that C-I-D and for some form of killing. But there's a big problem with Rashbam's theory. There are a number of verses in the Bible. You remember Rashbam mentioned one verse that didn't seem to go along all that well with his theory. One who unwittingly slew Yirtzach, a fellow man. But actually, there are a number of verses that are more difficult than that one. First problematic verse. Umatza oto goel hadam michutz ligvul ir miklato veratzach goel hadam et harotzeach. Ain't low dumb. If the blood avenger comes upon him, the accidental murderer, outside the limits of his city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer, there is no blood guilt. Again, look at what
JPS did. I'm not blaming JPS. It's the Hebrew is so jarring to say that what the blood avenger is doing is retzicha. It's murder. They use that verb murder, the ratzach, and then to say at the end, ein lo dam, there's no blood guilt on his account, and it's not culpable. You know, as we say here in Israel, osha osha, one or the other. Either it's culpable. If it's ritzicha, then it should be culpable, and if it's not ritzicha, then if it's not culpable, what are you doing using the verb ratzach? Okay, so you might say here that the Torah might be hinting that it isn't comfortable with blood avengers. We saw Shadal saying that last week, that the Torah wanted to eradicate the idea of blood avengers, and that even though there is no formal culpability here, because the Torah did not feel that it could come right out and outlaw all blood avengers, it's hinting to us by using the verb ratzach, and is ratzach et harotzeach, that this vendetta kind of atmosphere of the relative of the deceased deciding to do to the person who killed his relative the same thing that was done to him. So we have here the problem that the rotzeach is also somebody who committed accidental homicide, And so both of the words here, both the word beratzach and the word harotzeach, are in some ways difficult. And if this verse is not difficult enough, here's another one that is even more difficult. And Professor Blitzstein, Zichron Livracha, was not the first person to point this out, but he was the first person that I read that pointed it out. But after I read Blitzstein's article, I looked at all his footnotes, and I found how many commentators actually struggled to try to understand a verse like this. It's really hard. Kol makeh nefesh lefi edim yirtzach et harotzeach. So I gave you a literal translation here. If anyone kills a person, the murderer may be murdered only on the evidence of witnesses. But we don't talk about a court putting somebody to death as committing murder, unless, you know, you are a radical opponent of capital punishment, that you might be tempted to use the verb ratzach to refer to what a court of law does. But when the Torah said that, you know, makeh ish vamet, mot yumat, when it said that capital punishment is required, then what in the world is it doing here using the verb yirtzach to describe what a court of law is doing here? That, you know, we have the testimony of witnesses. Shadal, I didn't bring you the text here, I'll just tell you. Shadal, Samuel David Luzzatto in the 19th century in Italy, he's so troubled by this verse that he kind of, he says, this couldn't be referring to a court. The Bible would never use the verb ratzach to refer to a court. It must be referring to the blood avenger, which is difficult to say in the context there. But he says it just because the verb troubles him so much. And so he says it's referring that even the blood avenger is allowed to be a blood avenger only if there were witnesses to the crime. I think this issue came up before about like what level of proof is required by a blood avenger according to the Bible. That's never made clear in the text. And so Shadal is saying that that's what's going on here. But Blitzstein tries to take these texts in a different direction. You may either like or not like what Blitzstein had to say about it. I'll share with you here what he wrote. He said, obviously, I don't speak here of biblical law, which knows of authorized killings of war, self-defense, and execution. But at the language level, the Torah teaches us that no word for the spilling of human blood could bear a less prohibitive denotation than any other. In other words, Blitzstein says, there is, with apologies to Rashbam, there is no sharp distinction in Hebrew between ratzach and harag. As in English, there's no doubt that we have this sharp distinction between to murder and to kill. And Blitzstein says there is no sharp distinction in Hebrew between in biblical Hebrew between ratzach and harag. In modern Hebrew, as far as I know, in modern Hebrew there is still this sharp distinction between ratzach and harag. Western thought distinguishes at a basic and indelible level, at the level of the word, between homicide and murder. Jewish usage does not make this distinction. Homicide means the killing of another human being, whether it is culpable or not. In any case, it would be called homicide. That's that CID root there. It's the killing of a human being is homicide. And murder means culpable. And Jewish usage does not make this distinction. The verbal integrity of the spilling of human blood is never violated. Homicide is not splintered in biblical Hebrew into the justifiable and the criminal. So that's Blitzstein's argument that on a certain level, he's trying to say in that article that Judaism, that the opinion that we saw a number of weeks ago that said that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon said, had we been in the Sanhedrin, nobody would have ever been put to death by a Jewish court. Blitzstein is arguing that if that's not a direct outgrowth of biblical law, because biblical law is talking about all these people who are put to death, he says it is a direct outgrowth of biblical thought and of biblical language. And the difference between biblical language and our language is that we in the West, we make a strong distinction between these verbs, and in Hebrew, we do not. Again, Blitzstein is arguing the precise opposite of what Rashbam argued. And again, to remind you, Professor Blitzstein, who just died fairly recently, was a great professor here at Ben Gurion University of the Negev in Be'er Sheva. He's originally an American, and he wrote this article in the 1960s. And you might see a little bit of the spirit of the 1960s when he was a student at Columbia, if I'm not mistaken, where opposition to capital punishment must have been, in the air in those days. And Blitzstein is trying to argue that you can find hints of that attitude in the Bible. I'm going to, I have more texts related to issues about homicide, but they are about a different issue. So I'm just going to look at the chat and see if there are questions to pick up now about this. Okay. What verb is used for ir hamiklat? So in the text there about the sometimes haratzach and sometimes harag is used there. If you punch someone during an argument and he falls down and smashes his head on a rock and dies, is that murder or manslaughter according to the Torah? To the best of my understanding, that would be manslaughter. That wouldn't be murder according to rabbinic law Irene suggests to us that Rashi worked for the church authorities in Troas, perhaps. Martha says that she had to take Latin as a short-lived French major, useful for reading Satyricon. Yes, it's a very useful language, although when I was forced to read it, to study it in high school, we used to all write language as a language as dead can be. First it killed the Romans, and now it's killing me. But I have found, shockingly, that Latin has been useful for me in my own scholarly work. Latin and Greek are still on offer at school in the UK. I took it up again at Haifa University. Very nice. That's great. And need it for, there are many things that we can use it for. Ego, sim, solus, sum, solus. Thank you, Gershon. You're right. Ego, sum, solus. Thou shalt kill the rodef, contra opponents of Ro versus Wade. I'm not going to go there, Gershon. Excuse me. They are saying it's murder in legalese, English justifiable manslaughter, but the families cannot exact blood vengeance, and the person who killed the other person would have to go to a safe city in the case of somebody who pushed somebody. Witnesses versus jury versus Sanhedrin, yes, could be any one of those things. Distinction in English would be murder and killing is also not consistent. Okay. The adjective premeditated is added to murder as killed him accidentally. Perhaps Rashbam meant to say that most of the time, that's possible. They're trying to say that most of the time. Okay. Thank you all for your comments. And Gershon, thank you for correcting my Latin. I will try to fix the slides before I send them off to Torah in Motion. And now we'll go on to the next issue, still relating to the issue of homicide.
Basher lo tzada, v'ha'elohim ina v'yado, v'samti l'cha makom asher yanus shama. If he didn't do it by design, but it came about by an act of God, I will assign you a place to which he can flee. So we've seen this verse before. We've discussed it a little bit before, but I wanted to talk about
one aspect of this verse, or of this idea, or of this halacha, if you will, that appears not here in Exodus. But we've already noted that these three verses about homicide say things in very compact kind of way, and later books of the Torah unpack the laws in much more detail. And one of the details that appears in the book of Numbers and Bamidbar, and we'll read about it in the Torah in a few weeks, is how long a person has to stay, somebody who committed accidental killing, how long that person has to stay in that city of refuge. So, in the book of Numbers, it says, V'itzilu ha'edat ha'rotzeach mi'ako el adam, v'yishivu oto ha'edah al ir mitlato asher nas shama, v'yashav ba admot ha'kohen ha'gadol, asher mashach oto v'shemen ha'kodesh. The assembly shall protect the manslayer from the blood avenger. Notice again, v'itzilu ha'edat ha'rotzeach is being referred to as a rotzeach here, even though he's being considered non-culpable. Again, a counterexample to Rashbam's theory. The assembly shall protect the manslayer from the blood avenger, and the assembly shall restore him to the city of refuge to which he fled, and there he shall remain until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the sacred oil. This is a very strange rule that an accidental murderer has to stay in the city of refuge until the high priest dies. Let's see what different commentators had to say about this. So Rashi, citing some traditional Midrashic and Talmudic sources, writes, until the death of the high priest, who serves to cause the Shekhinah to dwell in Israel and thereby prolong their days. While a murderer makes the Shekhinah depart from Israel and shortens the days of the living. He is therefore not worthy to stand anywhere near a high priest. So Rashi's first explanation here is that a killer and the high priest are antithesis. They're antonyms. The job of the high priest is to prolong our life. And what this killer did is that he shortened somebody's life. And so you have to keep them away from each other. So as long as the high priest is there, we have to keep the accidental killer away from him by hiding him away in a city of refuge. So there, clearly, it's being seen as a form of strong punishment. And then Rashi says another explanation. Because the high priest should have prayed that this misfortune might never happen in Israel in his days. That to some degree, the high priest bears a certain responsibility for everything that goes on in society. The buck stops with the high priest. The high priest is in charge of the values of our society, and he should have prayed that something like this wouldn't happen. And so why would it make sense for the accidental killer to stay in a city of refuge until the high priest dies? I think that Rashi here is building on an idea that appears in the Talmud. Let's imagine that your relative was an accidental killer and went to a city of refuge to pray to protect his life. And let's imagine that you know that your relative is going to have to stay there in the city of refuge until the high priest dies. The Gemara says that the families of people who were guilty of accidental homicide used to pray that the high priest would die. And so because the high priest did not fulfill his role of praying that things like this not happen in society, he finds himself living in a situation where a bunch of people are praying that he should die soon. Of course, it could actually even be worse than that, that people might be trying to target the high priest and kill him so that their relatives might get out of this sort of prison. So that's how Rashi deals with the issue. Rambam tries to provide, perhaps they might say, a more rational and perhaps even psychological explanation. So here's what Rambam writes in the Guide to the Perplexed. The chance of returning from exile depends on the death of the high priest, the most honored of men, and the friend of all Israel. By his death, the relative of the slain person becomes reconciled, for it is a natural phenomenon that we find consolation in our misfortune when the same misfortune, or a greater one, has befallen another person. Amongst us, no death causes more grief than that of the high priest. In other words, what happens when the high priest dies? Everybody is so broken up about this, they forget about the other people who have died. There are other relatives who have died, and they are no longer interested in being blood avengers. That's no longer on their mind, because now they have something bigger to worry about, the fact that the high priest is dead. And so now it is, Rambam is saying, it is now safe for the accidental killer to leave the city of refuge, the Ir HaMiklat, because it can be assumed that the relatives of the person who was killed were not as upset about it anymore, because now they have something bigger to be upset about. Another explanation of Rabbi Avadia Sforno, Italy, from around 500 years ago. He offers, I assume that most people would agree that this explanation is a little far-fetched. It's creative, but I think it's a little far-fetched. There are many disparate types of accidental actions, some almost unavoidable, and others, like negligence, being closer to a volitional act. Something that is done accidentally, there's a certain level of culpability in many of the things that I do accidentally that, you know, if I were more careful, these things wouldn't have happened. And so in everything that is done that is accidental, there's a different level of culpability or of responsibility. Accordingly, the Torah gives varying penalties to accidental killers. Some wait only a short time for the high priest to die, and others die in exile before the high priest dies. So somebody could be there for the rest of their life, and somebody could be there for a day or for a week or for a month, because the high priest dies right away. And so that's all interesting and creative, but then here's where it becomes a little hard to swallow. This is the justice of the omniscient God, who can thus punish each accidental killer in a manner conforming to the severity of the killer. So God arranges for every accidental killer to be in a city of refuge for the appropriate amount of time. And he can do that because there isn't the same formula, because the formula is until the high priest dies. And that could be like
any amount of time from a day to never in the lifetime of the accidental killer. And so, you know, if you have like 20 accidental killers sitting in a city of refuge, then to assume that it would be a simple and rational thing for God to arrange the high priest to die at the time that's the appropriate time for each one of them to have atoned for the culpability involved in their accidental killing. That part of this seems a little stretched to me. But I would like to finish off here with Rashbam's explanation on why the accidental killer stays in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Rashbam writes, Admot HaKohen HaGadol Lefi Pshuto Kol Yemei HaShofet HaGadol. Following the plain meaning of scripture, this means that the murderer must stay in the city of refuge until the chief judge dies. This is like the idea of Isaiah talks about the great king of Babylon who never released his prisoners to their homes. That the person who is responsible for public order, if you have murderers, if you have criminals walking free in the country, then this brings the justice system into disrepute. And so as long as the high priest is alive, and it's his job, according to Rashbam, to be preserving public good in society, public safety in society, that is why it would be like an insult to the high priest to have this murderer walking the street. Rashbam writes that here, you know, like it expresses this thought in, I think I just counted them up in like 11 words after saying, here's what the verse says. Later on, Chizkuni, Menachem ben Chizkia, who often follows in the footsteps of Rashbam, he expands on this idea and he writes, until the death of the high priest, so that people won't speak poorly of the high priest when they see this murderer walking freely among people outside of the city of refuge, with the high priest not punishing the murderer. And it is the duty of the high priest to do something, as it is written, should a man act presumptuously and disregard the priest charged with serving the Lord your God. But no one would speak poorly about a new priest concerning an offense that took place before his term. And so that's why when there is a change of regime, that is why various people get out of incarceration. And I'm sure you're all recognizing here that this idea of pardons that happen when one regime finishes and the next regime begins. I think that Rashbam and Chizkuni and perhaps Isaiah are suggesting that same that same kind of understanding of what it means to say that when the regime changes, people can get out of incarceration. The idea has been changed a little bit in the modern world with the presidents of the United States being petitioned to pardon various people before the end of their term. I think that Rashbam and Chizkuni
are arguing that generally it would be like the new monarch who is coming in, the new authority who's in charge of public welfare, who would say, you know, I don't have to worry about the enemies of the previous regime. That was the previous regime. So when there is a change in the regime, that is a standard sign when people are released. And so that's how Rashbam is understanding on the pshat level why it is that someone who committed accidental homicide would go free when the high priest dies, because now we have somebody new in charge of public order in society. Okay. I think that this is a good place to stop. Yes. And I'll take a look again at the chat and see if there's what is the point of Ir Miklat, banishment or protection? Bina asks. Really good question, Bina. It could be for punishment, or it could be for protection, it could be for atonement. All of these possibilities have been suggested by various thinkers. iPad, whoever that is, writes here, and didn't the mothers of high priests provide baked goods into the cities of refuge in order for them not to pray for the son's death? That's very good. That is what the Talmud says in Tractate Makot, that that's what they did, because they didn't want people to be praying for their sons to die. And so that, and Rashi is building on that when they say that, you know, the high priest should have been praying for things like this not to happen in his society, or perhaps he should have been taking steps. Yes, culpability. S.J. Sachs says, look at cigarette companies and Roundup car companies, that their products are not safe in every case. Certainly correct. Marty says, an admittedly tangential question, except for the Avodah and Yom Kippur, are there any halachic differences between the responsibilities of the Kohen Gadol and other priests? Yes. The Kohen Gadol used to bring a sacrifice every day in the Beit HaMikdash. The Kohen Gadol also had the right to be the all of the other priests had to go through a kind of lottery system or something like this to be the one who was responsible for any particular sacrifice on any particular day. But the Kohen Gadol could wake up in the morning and say, I can take care of these sacrifices today. I'm, you know, so it's his shift whenever he wants. And of course, there are also more restrictions on the high priest. There are a limited number of people that a high priest, a Kohen, has a limited number of women whom he is allowed to marry, and a high priest has a smaller group of women whom he is allowed to marry. What is the point of your miklat banishment? The shorish for miklat kalat. Martha asks, what's the shorish for miklat? Kalat in Hebrew means to catch or gather. And so that's the place that like catches you, gathers you in order, presumably, to offer you protection. Steve writes, safe cities.
I think
that's a modern usage of it. Kalatata, you know, that you like, you know, you take that in. Did you understand that? Yeah, that's how the verb might be used in.
Saraklita. What does it mean, saraklita?
Saraklita. That's right. That's a sort of absorption. Is it actually
absorption?
Yes.
To absorb them, so to give them a second chance.
Yes. Yes. So these cities absorb these murderers into the city, just as a new country absorbs new immigrants into the country. You're absolutely right that that's a use, but I really don't think that that was a use that goes back before modern times.
That's the reason that the Re'a Miklat, the inhabitants, were only Levi'im. from Zera Aharon. It's again the relation between Aharon, the responsibility or teaching.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. Safe City suggests that there is some element of doubt about the homicide being accidental. No, there's just concern that the blood avengers are not going to be satisfied when they're told, oh, it was an accident, and they're going to go around trying to kill this person. He is not a murderer walking among them, but is that really believed? That's the problem, Steve. That's right. That's the problem, that not everybody believes that the killing was accidental. Okay, I hope that next week will be the last session about homicide, and then we'll go on, and I don't even know whether it will take up the entire session, but I have one more thing that I want to talk about relating to these verses about homicide here in Parshat Mishpatim, and then we will go on to the following verses. I wish you all a good week, and...
Can I ask a question, a quick question, I hope?
Please. Go ahead.
The refugees in the Arei Miklat, so they were exempt from Aliyah L'Regel three times a year?
You know, I don't recall ever seeing a text that discusses that issue, but it certainly would make sense to me that you would that you would have a rule like that. Martha writes now in the chat to me, speaking of homicide, enjoy the election coming up in your country. Oy vey. That is true. Yes. I think that it's very logical what you're suggesting, and that the person in the Ir Miklat in the city of refuge would not go up to Jerusalem, because then Maho Ilu Chachamim B'Takanatam, that would not do anything good for them. Re'aliyah L'Regel, BS, how many actually typically perform it? Good question. They, you know, the halacha says that everybody is supposed to go, but who knows what compliance was like. We can't prove anything about what compliance was like. And thank you all, Cassie and others, for your thank yous. And I'll see you all next week.